Coming up on today's morning show, the monthly visit of the United Environmental Council with Nan Calvert. Today, a conversation about the birds of Wisconsin. Stay with us. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTDHD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. It's good to have Nan Calvert back in the studios today for her monthly visit to the morning show, although I'm sorry to report, as will become pretty evident as soon as she starts talking, that Nan is not feeling very well this morning, is nursing a nasty cold. And Nan, we appreciate you slogging over here through this illness and being with us nevertheless.
Well, it's my pleasure.
The cold, not so much.
But the cold. Being here is my pleasure.
All right. And we're really happy to have with us on the phone, joining us as our special guest for this morning show today, Nick Anich, who is the coordinator of something called the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas Project, which is under the auspices of the Wisconsin DNR, the Department of Natural Resources. And this is actually a follow-up study to a similar survey, which had already been done. And we're going to be talking with him about the purpose of this project, its scope, what has been learned thus far, and what is hoped to be learned. And we'll also learn something about the really essential role that is played by a small army of volunteers fanned out across the state of Wisconsin, who are essential participants in this project. Nick Anich, we welcome you to the morning show.
Hi, good to be here.
Good to be talking with you, and thanks for joining us.
Sure.
Nan, maybe you could say a quick word about your own encounter with the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas Project. What did you know about this before you connected with Nick Anich?
Well, with the current project, quite a number of months ago, quite a number of us got an announcement talking about that, they were looking for sites and they were looking for volunteers. And it's just a very exciting thing to be involved in, especially because we know that our breeding bird populations are plummeting for various and sundry reasons, not only in Wisconsin, but also globally, sadly. And so it's really important to figure out what species of birds are breeding, where are they breeding, how are their habitats doing, and then what can we do just as, citizens, can we do anything to support our native bird populations? So there are hundreds of volunteers who provide information, and essentially it becomes a very comprehensive field study documenting the presence and abundance of birds that breed and raise their young in given areas.
Nick Anich, maybe you could explain why we're talking about breeding birds, what that term really means. I mean, because in one sense, don't all birds breed? I mean, it almost sounds like kind of a redundant sort of term, and yet it's obviously important to this particular study and its focus. Explain the term, please.
So, I mean, we've got birds in Wisconsin year-round, but the breeding birds are kind of the ones that we think of our birds. I mean, these are the ones that we have the responsibility in the state for making sure that they have the habitat necessary to nest. So, some atlases actually record the birds year-round. But this one, we're mostly concentrating on what we kind of think of as our birds.
So, in other words, the birds that breed here versus the breeds only, versus those birds that only pass through, that breed someplace else.
Right,
and then,
not to discount the importance of the state for migration or wintering habitat, but, you know, if there is any component of the life cycle which is most important, it's you know, reproducing.
Before we start talking more about this project, maybe, Nick, we could find out just a little bit about you. First of all, how long have you been with the Wisconsin DNR? And ahead of that, where do you come from originally, and did anything in particular prompt your interest in the general field?
Well, I'm a native of Ashland. I pretty much got into birds in my undergraduate at St. Olaf College. I took a vertebrate biology class there with Dr. Gene Bacco, and I had to learn, you know, all my different classes of vertebrates, and so I had to learn my birds, and then we went out on field trips, and, you know, I started seeing things that I had seen in the specimen tray in real life, and that's kind of how I got into it.
So how long have you been with the Wisconsin DNR?
Since 2010. I originally got hired on to radio track spruce grouse up in spruce swamps up north.
Can you translate that for us? What does that mean?
So it was a project basically to follow the movements of these spruce grouse. They're state threatened, and you know, they're kind of hard to come by. They live in these spruce tamarack bogs, so with, you know, a very mossy ground cover, and we didn't really know much about them. Throughout the project, we just learned more about their habitat use, and I think we figured that there were probably more of them out there than people thought, but they're very secretive. They're very hesitant to flush, and they'll sit up in a conifer and not move, so they're not often seen.
And your responsibilities for that were what?
I was the guy who found the grouse, and we went out and we caught them, and we put a radio transmitter on them, and then we took the radio antenna and tracked them and gathered location points to learn more about, you know, their habitat use and space use.
Huh. So you've been one of the chief birdmen at Wisconsin DNR then?
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of us, but I guess I'm one of them.
Very good. Well, let's start talking about this particular project, which we want to make our primary focus today on the morning show, namely the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas Project. First of all, as I think maybe Nan mentioned in her preliminary comments, this is actually a follow-up to a similar project which has already been done. I don't know if that happened while you've been at the Wisconsin DNR, but what can you tell us about the origins of all this?
Yeah, so the first Breeding Bird Atlas, the field work on that ran from 1995 to 2000. And you can actually find, they put out a book, Atlas of the Breeding Birds of Wisconsin, by Noel Cutright, Betty Harriman, and Bob Howe. And so this study is pretty much replicating the methods of that study. So that study, you know, 1,600 observers went out, collected 170,000 breeding records across the whole state, and they were able to produce basically maps of where the different species are nesting in the state.
And remind me, when did that occur?
1995 to 2000.
Okay.
So we're starting this project 20 years after the first atlas, which is pretty typical for these bird atlases.
Right. And I suppose then part of the point is to trace what we're assuming are declining numbers for at least many of these species, and to chart just how steep that decline might be.
Yeah, some are declining, some are increasing, and some will be shifting in other ways that we didn't know about. So it's basically collecting some of the most basic information on these bird species. You know, there's really only one way on a large scale that we know about bird populations, and that's the Federal Breeding Bird Survey. And so it happens every summer, and experienced observers go out and do these point counts where they stand in one spot and record all the birds they detect, which is mostly just by ear, listening to the bird songs. And so you stand for a place at 3 minutes, and then you drive down the road, and you stand another place for 3 minutes. And so you do 50 points in the morning.
Wow.
And doing that year after year since 1966 is the primary way that we know about how bird populations are doing. And for birds that are, you know, easy to detect, they're singing first thing in the morning, and they're distributed near roads and stuff, it actually does a pretty good job at tracking trends. But there's a whole lot of bird species that you're not going to detect in 3 minutes listening by the side of the road, you know. So I think this atlas is one way to get better information on a whole lot of species that we're really not keeping track of in any systematic way.
For those of you just joining us, we're speaking with Nick Onich, who is with the Wisconsin DNR, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. He is the coordinator for something called the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas Project. Nan Calvert is with us in the studios as well. And we're about to delve into some of the details about how this project is actually done. And Nick Onich, as the coordinator, is probably very, very well acquainted with each and every detail that goes into something that is as massive and complicated as this. First of all, when did this current project begin, or is it just getting underway, or has it been underway for a while?
This year is the first year of field work, and things are pretty much wrapping up right now. We still are getting a trickle of observations in. People are seeing some baby cardinals being fed at their bird feeders and things, but for the most part, most of the species in the state are done breeding. Things really got started almost 2 years ago now. I should mention the DNR is not the only organization on this project. The Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, the Western Great Lakes Bird and Bat Observatory, and the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative are also partners on this.
So explain the work that is done by the many volunteers who help really make this possible. If they're not standing by the road for 3 minutes listening for bird songs, what are they doing? What are each of your volunteers charged with doing?
Well, I'll say there's kind of like maybe two general types of people who do this. You don't necessarily have to be an expert to do this. You can just be a regular person who has a bird nesting in your yard, or you're driving down the road and you see some baby birds. So those people, can just get on our website and enter it into our system, which I'll talk about more later. But, the bulk of the effort is probably coming from kind of our hardcore birder community, people who really know all their birds, know them by song. And for those people, we are encouraging them to sign up for an Atlas block. And so these Atlas blocks, we kind of gridded out the whole state using if you're familiar with these USGS topo maps, they're kind of a little bit longer than they are tall, 7.5-minute USGS topos, and we broke those into six pieces, and the center east of those six pieces is what we call the priority block. So it ends up being about a 3-mile by 3-mile square area, and there's 1,130 of these gridded out over the whole state.
The entire state?
Yes. So in a very even fashion. And then we had 153 specialty blocks, which we also selected because they had very unique habitat and we wanted those covered. And so basically, we're encouraging these birders to sign up for one of these blocks. And so that's your block, and your mission is kind of to go out and try to find most of the birds that are breeding in that habitat. So you want to go out and cover all the different habitat types. The prime breeding season is June and July, but you want to get in a couple early visits and a couple late visits and a couple visits at night to detect owls and nightjars and rails and other species which might only be calling at night. And so you're out there and you're recording the birds that you see, and you're also recording their behavior. And so we have what we call these breeding codes, and it's basically a list of the bird's behavior starting from just observed, where you saw a bird but you don't have any reason to think that it might be breeding in the area, up to possible. Possible is just you see a bird in the appropriate habitat at the right time of year, or you have a bird singing in the appropriate habitat at the right time of year. And then the next codes up are probable codes. Some probable codes are a pair of birds in suitable habitat, a bird defending its territory, a bird agitated, you might be close to its nest, a singing male you found in the same spot 7 or more days apart, you think he's singing on his territory. Those are probable codes. And then you have confirmed codes where you're sure the bird was nesting in the area. Obviously things like a bird sitting on a nest with eggs, oftentimes you don't find the nest. Some other confirmed codes are like carrying nest material, if you see a bird with some stick or grass in its mouth, or carrying food, you see a bird with a mouthful of caterpillars headed off to feed its young. So basically, you go out and you're walking around your block, and you're writing down the list of birds, and you're writing down your breeding behaviors, and then you go put it into our website, and then our website is kind of making maps and lists and keeping track of all of this.
Hmm. This helps me understand one question. I mean, like, for instance, my wife and I in our yard had nesting birds this summer.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, as far as I know, there was nobody probing around our yard from the Wisconsin DNR. But someone might have been out on the street or someplace close by and might have detected, actually, this mother bird or father bird would have had some clue that nesting was occurring, even if they didn't lay their eyes on the nest itself, which was in our yard.
Right, and we're not going to find every bird or every nest, but this is, you know, our study design kind of has us sampling as much of the state as we can. And, yeah, it's much more easy to find some evidence of breeding short of the nest.
Right. The thing that is a little curious to me is, It seems like it would be commonplace for birds to get sort of counted twice, or maybe many more times than twice. Is that sort of figured in the calculations?
Yeah, that doesn't really matter. In fact, we're encouraging people to input full lists every time they go out. Well, we can deal with that on the back end. We won't be assuming birds are twice as common as they are. The more data we have, the more that we and other researchers are going to be able to use this database to do different analyses.
Mm-hmm. How complicated is the matter of different kinds of birds behaving in different ways when it comes to something like breeding? Or, by and large, are many of these basic patterns of behavior pretty much universal among birds? I mean, that all birds squawk when you get too close to their nest or whatever it might be. Or does the fact that there is variation in bird behavior maybe complicate the matter of observing and trying to discern which birds are breeding?
Well, I think it kind of depends on the situation, but there are general patterns, but I think the number of bird species in the state and the variety of their behavior and habitats and everything is one of the things that people find really engaging. A lot of the people that are participating in this who've been birding for 20 years are commenting that this project is making them slow down and observe birds more, and people are learning more about bird behavior and habitat associations and birds that they had in their neighborhood that they didn't even know about. So, I think the basics of this project are very simple, but the more and more you get into it, it's quite deep and you can get a lot out of it.
Right. So how often are these observations made by a given volunteer?
Well, we don't really micromanage anybody's time here. The general thought is people probably put in 20 or 25 hours in a block over the course of the season. So a lot of that will be a couple big summer visits. You know, on some of those June and July days, you can easily end up with 50 or 60 species in a day and, you know, 10 or 20 confirmed species. So, it's all going to depend on what someone's block looks like. A block that has all of one habitat type, you don't necessarily have to spend as much time working it as a very diverse block, and some blocks have easy access, and, you know, up north there's some blocks that have, like, very few roads through them at all, so.
So is it too early for us to be talking about results, or have you already seen some numbers and gotten a sense of some of the trends?
We crunched the year one statistics, and it is too early to say definitively, like, this species is declining or something. But for year one, we had over 700 people participate. We got data from 2,600 Atlas blocks. There's been over 24,000 checklists submitted, documenting over 1.7 million birds. One of the obvious things when you look at the distribution maps is we now have wild turkeys across the whole state. If you look at the first Atlas map, into the north woods, the northern third of the state pretty much did not have turkeys in the year 2000. And now we have turkeys I think, in just about every county.
Well, and even in certain urban areas, right? Or was that already in place?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think they have undergone a pretty good expansion here in the last 15 years.
Hmm. So is this the kind of study in which it in and of itself is possible to start discerning some reasons, for instance, for the resurgence of the wild turkey versus the decline of some other species that we are not seeing so much of? Or is this generally speaking more about the numbers and a different study needs to be done to determine some causes?
Yeah, I think of this more as a broad-scale foundational thing. Like, you know, if we got 230 to 240 species breeding in the state, this might be the thing that says, hey, look at this species. It's really been tanking in the last 20 years. And then another study comes along and starts to investigate that.
So what is your sense, working on the concern of birds in Wisconsin, what is your sense of what the most important factors are in the rise and fall of various bird populations? What can we point to that are the most significant factors in the environment around us?
I mean, going forward on a large scale, it's going to be habitat change and climate change, you know, affecting these birds' distributions and ranges. You know, things like, well, one group of birds that we're worried about right now is the grassland bird species. And, you know, as the agriculture becomes more intensive, as hay fields are mowed too early, as hay fields are converted into other types of crops, like that's a group of species that I think is really being hit hard.
And is part of the point of this study the hope that some of those matters can be affected and turned around somehow? I mean, is this ultimately a study that has sort of advocacy at its root or at its heart?
Yeah, no, I think this is the starting point. This is where we say, now we know for sure that Western meadowlarks are declining or something like that. And, you know, I think the other powerful thing about this study is birds are a pretty good indicator species. Like, it's much easier to go out and survey birds than it is to look for, you know, some more secretive animal or to do some sort of an intensive vegetation analysis everywhere. You know, if we find Western meadowlarks are declining, what that really means is our grasslands are changing in some way. So I think this study is an easy way to kind of tip us off that certain ecosystems are changing in some way.
Hmm. Are similar studies of this scope and sort of intensity being done elsewhere? I mean, for instance, does the state of Minnesota do this, the state of Michigan, the state of Illinois? I mean, any of our neighbors?
Yeah, Minnesota just finished an atlas, I think, a year or two ago. Right now, Rhode Island, sometimes I dream about having a state as small as Rhode Island to do this. So it opened up a lot of possibilities. And soon to be Virginia are starting an atlas.
Because I suppose part of the concern here is that birds don't know about state boundaries, for instance, and so in some cases, one might hope if there's some sort of shift in our certain habitats that maybe birds find some other place in northern Illinois or someplace close by where their breeding is occurring. But I suppose that's very much wishful thinking. Chances are the kind of transformation that we're talking about that's happening here is happening in most of the states across the country.
Well, I mean, I think it all depends. You know, with some of these shifts predicted by climate change, we very well could have our birds gradually shifting into northern Minnesota or something like that.
Nan, what are your kind of informal observations as someone who is out in the wild quite a lot in terms of the species that you are concerned about?
Well, just one thing I'd like to mention is that driving around or just hiking around, there are wild turkeys everywhere. And it's a wonderful thing to see because we didn't see that for a long time. And a lot of people don't know that wild turkeys were extirpated from Wisconsin decades ago because of overhunting and other factors. And then they were reintroduced and they've successfully established themselves again. So I think that's a testimony to the fact that you can do something about declining bird populations in some instances. Birds that are more specifists, they only eat certain things, or they're only able to nest and breed and rear their young in very specific habitats, delicate habitats. That's a whole nother story. One thing I'd like to ask, Nick, is once this is all said and done, does it have the capability to affect policy in terms of land management and so on?
Yeah, I mean, I think it will, especially with the DNR's involvement. You know, the DNR is always looking for information as we do our different conservation planning about, you know, what's on this property, which properties should we invest the most energy into, you know. So I think this is going to fill a lot of holes for the DNR, you know, on some basic information with species that have information needs, on some conservation planning things that have to do with which birds are on which properties. So I think from the DNR end especially, we have a lot of potential to just get the information we need to be managing these properties efficiently. And then, you know, this database is going to be publicly available. So if there's scientists out there that are keen to dig into it, you know, it's going to be out there. People, I'm hoping that people are able to use it to run different analyses and, you know, dig into it and find out a lot of interesting, useful stuff for conservation.
You said earlier that there are over 1,100 blocks, but not all of them are being assessed or observed. Is it too late to get people into those areas, or can people continue or, you know, start to contribute information?
No, this is year one of the project, of a five-year project, so there's definitely an opportunity to contribute. The 1,100 blocks are our priority blocks. Those are the ones that we really, really want to complete to call the atlas finished. But we don't want to discourage people from submitting observations from anywhere else. If you have a house or a cabin or your commute to work that is not in a priority block and you see some nesting birds, you absolutely can enter it into the system and it will wind up in the atlas.
And can people go to the website and see which blocks still currently need observers?
Yeah, the main website is wsobirds.org/atlas. And we do have a block request tool where people can look and see what's already been called and what is available. And, again, we're encouraging, you know, primarily pretty seasoned birders to be the ones signing up for a block. You don't have to sign up for a block to participate in the project. You can always just submit any observations you see.
So in other words, there's two different ways to participate. One is, as in a sense, a little more casual observer,
yeah.
And the other is to be a volunteer who really, in a sense, takes responsibility for a given space.
Yes, and we also, I should mention, we have a county coordinator for every county, and you can find their email on the website. So if you are someone who thinks this sounds fun but don't really know your birds, we are trying to match up people who would be willing to go out in the field with you. So that's an option, too.
Very good. And then over the course of these 5 years, then, what sort of ultimately happens? Is this a matter of just accumulating basic data, or is it a matter of tracking the data through the course of those 5 years, or maybe both?
Yeah, pretty much both. I mean, we're going to have our hands full here. One of the objectives is trying to get the blocks covered, and then as the data comes in, we're still in the process of building a system that allows us to kind of filter through it and catch mistakes and keep tabs on it.
Well, it's a fascinating project, and I suspect, as you just said, you have your hands full coordinating something
yeah.
that is so extensive.
Yeah, it is. I mean, there's all these issues. We have, you know, all sorts of subcommittees that I spend my life on conference calls with. You think an issue is fairly straightforward, and then you sit down to hash out the details, and there's a lot of thought has gone into this from a lot of people.
Yeah. It's impressive. Nan, before we let Nick go, any other questions you have for him?
Sort of harkening back to the study 20 years ago, Can you speak to the kind of findings that they came up with and how that changed land management or policy?
I just know that, you know, talking to people in the DNR, a lot of people get a lot of use out of that first Atlas book. They're always the first Atlas book, in addition to just having the maps, has an account for each species that tells you about the habitat it likes, and it also has accounts that describe all the ecosystems in Wisconsin. I think a lot of people refer back to that book just for the basic information. I mean, a lot of that information we kind of take for granted now, but it was news back then. Some of these bird ranges we thought we knew, but there were surprises, and we expect that this time around too.
Remind our listeners once again of the website address if people want more information and perhaps are interested in being some sort of participant in all this.
Yeah, the website is wsobirds.org, which is the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology website, then /Atlas gets you to the Atlas part of it. If you wind up on wsobirds.org, you can also click the word that says Atlas on the top. And we have an email list that you can sign up for, and we have a Facebook page. And if you're on those things, you will be in the loop.
Excellent. Excellent. Nicholas Onich is the coordinator of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas Project for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Nick, it was great to speak with you, and maybe we'll get to have a follow-up conversation at some point as this project goes forward. But in the meantime, we're glad we could have this conversation today on the morning show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Thank you again for your time. We appreciate it. Bye-bye. And, Nan, before we let you go back to your sick bed, I suspect you have a few calendar events you want to share with us.
Yes, I do. There are three exciting things I'd like to share. First of all, the Racine Dominican Eco Justice Center, and this is apropos to what we were speaking about today, they're sponsoring a field trip to the Aldo Leopold Center and Crane Foundation on October 15th. You have to be at the Eco Justice Center promptly at 7 a.m. on the 15th, and you'll come back sometime in the very late afternoon, early evening. You can go to the website if you need more details or just call the Eco Justice Center. Secondly, there's a fundraising event for our Southeast Gateway group of Sierra Club. It's once again, they're offering fresh cranberries that they've procured directly from a family-owned farm in Wisconsin for a one-pound bag. It's $3.75, and I'm told that these are really big cranberries. The deadline for ordering is October 28th. All you need to do is call Jeff Seitzma to order, and you can go to their website, too, and please order lots of them. We need to support our conservation organizations. And if you're searching for something really cool to do for a Halloween experience, you need to search no further, because on October 17th at Sino Conservancy from 7 until 9 p.m., there will be a live theatrical performance of Dracula. And the tickets are $15. At some point in time during the performance, towards the end, you actually get to pursue Dracula for a short distance through the woods until his ultimate demise. There's a reception following the play, and also there will be an optional night hike. Tickets are still available, and you can call 262-539-3222.
Very good. Well, Nan Calvert, thanks for being here despite not feeling well, and we trust that you'll be in robust health again come November in your next visit to the morning show.
Yes, absolutely.
All right, take care. The time is 8:44. Part two of the morning show is coming up now here on WGTD. I have just finished reading one of the most intriguing and beautiful children's books I have ever read. And I mean that very, very sincerely. A book called Imaginary Fred. And in this book, Imaginary Fred, we are taken into the life and heart and mind of a young boy who imagines for himself an imaginary friend. And there's all kinds of people who, of course, have done that in their own lives at some point. But the way this particular story is spun is absolutely magical. And I'm so excited to talk with the two very, very talented gentlemen responsible for creating this book. And any of you who have children and many children's books on your shelves very likely know their names already. One of them is Owen Colfer, who is very well known for his best-selling series, Artemis Fowl, and also some freestanding novels, including Airmen. And he is born in Ireland and has done great, great work in this field, as has his collaborator on this book, Oliver Jeffers, who is quite an amazing artist. And many of you might know his much-loved debut book, How to Catch a Star. And you might also know The Day the Crayons Quit, a really great book for which he provided the illustrations. And together they have fashioned this book called Imaginary Fred, which is published by an imprint of HarperCollins. And I could not be more excited or honored to speak with these two gentlemen for the next few minutes. Owen Colfer and Oliver Jeffers, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks, Greg. We like you. That's good. You can keep coming with the compliments.
That's the best introduction from your honeyed voice. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome, and I really meant it. I happen not to have kids, just two golden retrievers, but a fair number of children's books cross my desk in this work that I do at the radio station. So I know something about what it takes to put a good children's book together.
Well, it's interesting because so often I try to refrain from calling the books that I make children's books. And instead call them picture books because they're not just for children, they're for everybody. And more I'm finding adults alone are coming along to book signings and events just because they appreciate the books themselves. Yeah. And less I'm hearing, oh, I'm here without a kid as an excuse, and it's just okay to like these books now. I'm glad that you brought that up.
And I think kids can look at Oliver's pictures and really enjoy them, but adults can look at them with a more experienced eye and appreciate the craft and the standard of the artwork. So there is something for everybody.
But they just don't look like weird scribbles. And there's artistic integrity there somewhere.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Owen.
Absolutely. Could you say something about the collaboration between the two of you, which resulted in the creation of this lovely book? First of all, did you begin collaborating on this book with some kind of idea already in mind? And take us from the inception of the idea to the completion of this beautiful book.
Well, for me, Greg, I just wanted to work with Oliver. And we didn't have an idea initially. We just agreed in principle that if I could come up with something and Oliver liked it, then we would work together. So I was very happy about that. I'm at the stage of my career where I've done 40 books, and I'm starting to pick projects purely based on the people I'm working with. And I'm lucky, fortunate I can do that. And so I approached Oliver in New Zealand, of all places, where we met up at a book festival.
He knew my defenses would be low there.
Yeah, I waited. I waited until he was really tired and jet lagged, and I just said, sign this. And next thing, we had a contract. But it happened very quickly then. I sent the book into Oliver. He sent me back the initial drawings, and it was smooth sailing.
It really was. It was straightforward. There was no drama, no hissy fits or fights or tantrums. It was as straightforward as a collaboration can get and as enjoyable as a collaboration can get. Owen had a fantastic idea, which I could immediately visualize, and he loved the way that I had visualized it, and the whole book was just pulled from there.
Hmm. Well, how long a period are we talking from the moment you signed the dotted line to the moment the book was essentially finished and ready for publication?
Well, Oliver does tease me that I wrote it very quickly and that it took him a long time to illustrate it. I wrote it in a couple of days. And then we did change substantially, I suppose, some bits. But from beginning to end, if you put all the work together, would it have been 4 months altogether?
Yeah, about four or five months, So we agreed to do it, and HarperCollins said that they were publishing. We thought, that's great. And then I kind of remembered that there was a publishing deadline that came in place with the contract with HarperCollins.
And you had a fine art exhibition at the same time.
Yeah, so I surprised myself by, oh, wait, the book is due when? But it was very straightforward and enjoyable. And it's like some of the great projects, they happen. They happen quickly and effortlessly, and it's almost like the book made itself in some ways.
Mm-hmm. As maybe people have garnered from my brief introduction and the fact that it's titled Imaginary Fred, we're talking about a young boy who has an imaginary friend. ahead of us talking specifically about this plot, such as it is. I wonder if each of you brought to this project your own imaginary friends or a background of having indulged in that kind of very special kind of imaginary fancy.
I did. I had a series of imaginary friends. I think I was very heavily influenced by pop culture at the time. And the first movie I ever saw was the James Bond movie Thunderball. And at the time, I was getting a little bit of a hard time in school. So I imagined Sean Connery was protecting me. And I would talk to Sean. But he was always wearing that red scuba outfit. when he was my imaginary friend and little denim shorts, so very specific. But I could literally see him and talk. I think when you're a boy of 6 or 7, and the first movie you ever see on the big screen is a James Bond movie, it really had an effect on me.
First movie I ever saw on a big screen was Jaws. My dad made a terrible mistake.
That was a bad.
He told dinner party stories years later that I would go down and wake him up and ask, "Daddy, can sharks climb stairs?"
Hmm.
And traumatize
they
me.
They can climb.
As it turns out,
no, I'm just trying to reawaken that trauma.
So you wanted to talk about imaginary friends, but with a twist, a very intriguing twist. And I wonder, Owen, how long did it take you to kind of come up with this particular universe in which imaginary friends sort of operate the way that they do in Imaginary Fred?
Well, it's always been my habit to try and come at things from a different perspective and maybe take the character who might be supporting character in another book and make him the main character. And in this case, Imaginary Fred, who is the imaginary friend, he's the main character, because what happens to the friends when they're no longer needed? And that's what I wanted to explore. What happens to these guys when their friend abandons them for a real friend? And so we follow Fred as he tries to make one of his friendships permanent, and this would be the first time this has ever happened. And I thought that was an interesting idea.
Right, where the devotion is so strong that the boy wants to retain his imaginary friend even as he finally makes his first, in a sense, real friend.
Exactly.
I suppose one of the really beautiful things about this book is that it really gets us thinking about what friendship is all about. And I suppose that's also one of those lessons that a reader can sort of draw their own conclusions from, depending on, I suppose, how old they are.
Of course, and then it's also that interesting period where a third friend comes into the fray, and if you've got a best friend, or if you're older and your roommate or whatever it is meets a new girl or has a new partner, it's that somebody new coming into the mix can often upset the balance, and it's about dealing with that as much as it is dealing with your own friend.
Hmm. When actually crafting the text, how much did you think about level of difficulty or complexity? If you were hoping to write a book that would appeal to a wide range of readers, then how do you sort of pitch, in a sense, the difficulty level?
I think it's a natural thing for me, because I was a primary teacher for 15 years, and one of the very valuable lessons I learned there was how to talk to kids. And what I really learned was you don't really change anything. And a lot of people who visit schools make a huge mistake, because they launch into a sing-song voice. "Now, boys and girls, today we're going to talk about fire safety." And the kids hate that. You know, they want someone who's going to speak to them as an intelligent being. So the only thing you change is you make it appropriate for them. So if they're only 7, you don't want to talk about violence too much. So with this, I just wrote a story that I could tell to anybody. And hopefully anybody who heard it would like it.
I wonder, Oliver Jeffers, if you could say a word about your artwork in this book. And I so wish, of course, we were on television instead of radio, because, of course, we have to really leave it to our listeners' imaginations or they need to seek this out one way or another to see the visuals that you have created. You have an intriguing style all your own that at a glance seems quite primitive and, in fact, is so sophisticated and so nuanced. Have you always drawn in this particular way? And again, when you think about the artwork that you're going to do for a particular book, are you thinking about a particular kind of reader as you craft these wonderful and intriguing illustrations?
Well, to answer the first part of the question, yes, that is the way that I draw, and that is my handwriting. With this case, it's simple line artwork, which reference the old classical style of illustrations that I enjoyed when I was growing up, like the Shel Silverstein or Sempé. And it steps out of the way to let the story be told. So the art is not overpowering anything. And in fact, it's entirely black and white until Fred appears on the scene, and he is the only splash of color the whole way through. So there's a subtlety about it all that just lets the story flow and be told without becoming an obstacle to that. The way in which I draw, it is that just is it. It's a simplicity, but based very much on observations of reality. And there's, I think, with the actual style of storytelling, there's a flow and an ease about that suits the writing.
I especially love how you have chosen to illustrate Fred, the imaginary friend of the young boy, and it's sort of a pixelated image, and it's just right, and the splash of color that's included is also, I think, just right. Did you have a lot of rough drafts and crumpled up papers in the wastebasket before you finally settled on this?
I experimented a little bit with. I knew what the rough outline and what Fred would look like from his characteristics point of view, but to try and portray somebody who's not really there was difficult. And whenever I was playing about with the idea of the book being just black and white, I tried having Fred just as sort of a see-through, like a lighter line, but because of the subtleties of printing, he almost went away completely, and that wasn't going to work. And there is a technique for the pixelization of Fred is actually the way that newspapers are printed, and I was using it for this letterpress print I was doing, and just at the same time that I happened to be thinking about what Fred would look like, and I thought this could work. This might work, because it's not ghostly, it's kind of graphic and friendly, without him being a solid shape, and I experimented with it that one time, and it just worked.
A last question. Can we look forward to future collaborations between the two of you?
Well, I think we would be both open to that.
Yeah.
We don't have anything concrete yet. I only have one good idea a year, and I've used my idea for this year. So
I'm still working off the only ideas I had 10 years ago, and I'm running out, so yeah.
Well, we trust that some new wonderful idea will present itself in time for the two of you to combine your considerable talents again, as you have done so effectively in this wonderful new book. It's again called Imaginary Fred, and it's published by Harper, an imprint of HarperCollins, and it is absolutely worth seeking out. And not only for the young readers in your life, but it's a book you yourself are likely to enjoy as much as I did. Imaginary Fred, created by Owen Colfer and Oliver Jeffers. My thanks, gentlemen, to both of you for creating this beautiful book and for this time to converse today. I've enjoyed it.
Thanks, Greg.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Jack Rose from the local chapter of NAMI, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. October is National Mental Illness Awareness Month. Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for The Morning Show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. Our weather forecast is for partly sunny skies today, but a 40% chance of some afternoon rain showers. A high today of 76 degrees. A 40% chance of rain tonight as well, with a low of 53 degrees. A cloudy day tomorrow and turning a little cooler. Tomorrow's high just 58 degrees. Saturday, though, should be sunny with a high of 66. This is WGTDHD Kenosha.